From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 2003, we monitored the tug-of-war between the news media and the Bush administration, in which reporters have been accused of being both too timid and too critical. In Britain, however, the conflict has blazed into full-scale conflagration, most notably when a reporter for the usually circumspect BBC accused the government of sexing up its case for war in Iraq. A soft-spoken government scientist was named as its source and killed himself amidst a frenzy of publicity. As a result, both the Blair government and the BBC were forced to testify in a public inquiry that will release its findings later this month. But the Beeb is not the only news outlet to bare its claws, according to Michael Goldfarb, a London-based reporter for WBUR in Boston.
This was the year where all the gloves came off. From the right, you would almost expect it. I mean, Blair is a Labour Party member. But from the left, the viciousness was quite astounding.
What about the center?
Well, you know, the BBC is meant to be as fair and neutral a provider of news as there is in this country. And suddenly the government and the BBC were in front of a public inquiry unprecedented, defending their reporting, in the case of the BBC, and the government defending its own case for war. Extraordinary stuff.
So when you mention open warfare between the media and the Blair government, what else are you thinking of? What paper took off its gloves that customarily would have kept them on?
The Daily Mirror, a tabloid, which, you know, had several million readers, was so against this war that its front pages became kind of propagandistic works of art. In the first week of the war broke, I want to describe this headline to you. You have a front page, tabloid front page. The top of the page is a girl running screaming from a firefight. The bottom half of the picture is President Bush smiling and shaking hands with a crowd. And in the middle of this juxtaposition is this enormous headline, "He loves it." And the subhead is "Dead British troops paraded on Iraqi TV, 14 civilians killed in Baghdad market, and Bush whoops it up. War? Question mark." And then this big, bold headline, "He loves it."
Wow.
And, you know, because the linkage between the prime minister and the president was unique in people's minds. I mean, to show that kind of thing about Bush was condemning Tony Blair by association. And the headlines kept flowing from the Mirror.
But then again, the Daily Mirror was a tabloid, and they're famously hysterical.
Yes, tabloids in Britain, as we all know, are famously hysterical. But take a broadsheet newspaper like The Independent. You know, you began to see headlines with maybe 16 photos of carnage from the war juxtaposed into almost a work of art. And then stripped across the rest of the front page would be a report by Robert Fisk with a headline like, "Amid Allied Jubilation, a Child Lies in Agony, Clothes Soaked in Blood." And then Fisk would continue in his traditional purple prose style. And on the one hand, war is a terrible thing. And I was in Iraq and I saw some pretty terrible things. But, you know, with Fisk, you know what his point of view is, and he should probably be inside on the opinion pages. Instead, this was kind of like bringing all of the editorial out front, and you began to see how the government would begin to feel a bit under siege from this.
And ultimately, I guess, the Independent submitted to tabloid fever by actually becoming a tabloid.
That's right. You have your choice. You can buy the broadsheet paper if you want to read The Independent as a broadsheet, but they now put the paper out in tabloid size. It's been an amazing success and has added about 30,000 copies a day to their circulation, which is a big number for The Independent.
What about those papers that didn't succumb to tabloid theater? Did they stay circumspect throughout the war?
No, this war brought journalism to a new place in this country. In The Guardian, Hugo Young, who was The Guardian's main political columnist, and a man who has the stature in this country of, say, James Reston and Walter Lippmann. That is to say, you knew that what Hugo wrote was read in Downing Street and sometimes attended to, actually called for Blair to resign. This caused everybody to take in breath. It was as if to say, you don't understand, Prime Minister. You have lost your base by a factor of 10, and I'm calling on you to resign. Hugo tragically died. He was sick with cancer for the last several years. He died during the summer. So that power and pressure has kind of dissipated because the other people who are calling for his resignation, and a lot of people are, don't have his stature.
So, Michael, sum up for us then. Will the British government be able to make peace with the British media in 2004?
I don't see how it can happen. The British press has decided that it will press and press and press on Tony Blair. And, of course, we have the Hutton Inquiry report later in January. And when that comes out, who knows what will happen? It's a remarkable situation in a democracy, Brooke, to see the press arrogate to itself almost the power of being the official opposition.
Michael, thank you very much.
Brooke, my pleasure.
Michael Goldfarb reports from London for WBUR and spoke to us from the BBC.
Concerns this year about freedom and license have touched all media. The Internet has proved a Pandora's box, allowing all manner of spam and worse into the home and raising fears of wide-ranging invasions of privacy. But according to Lawrence Lessig, a Stanford University law professor and author of Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, the proposed cures may be worse than the disease, resulting in even less freedom and less privacy. Professor Lessig, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
In a recent article for Newsweek International, writer Stephen Levy described one possible future for the Internet, a very dark future. He wrote the following: "Picture, if you will, an information infrastructure that encourages censorship, surveillance, and suppression of the creative impulse, where anonymity is outlawed and every penny spent is accounted for, where powers that be can smother subversive or economically competitive ideas in the cradle, and no one can publish even a laundry list without the imprimatur of Big Brother. And you, Professor Lessig, he described as the Dean of Darkness, predicting for years that an open Internet is doomed. Tell me, Cassandra, when does the catastrophe strike? Will it be in 2004?
Well, sadly, I think 2004 will continue the march. We're seeing an increasing number of technologies and government-sponsored plans for finding ways to monitor and track what people do in the context of the Internet, and those technologies will radically change the nature of what it's like to be on the Internet.
Well, let's discuss the principal mechanism that will enable your every transaction or utterance, or for that matter, crime, to be tracked digitally. It's called certification. Would you tell me how it works?
The basic objective of these technologies of certification is to make it easier for people transacting with you on the Internet to have confidence that you are who you say you are, that you actually have the money you say that you have the authority to make the order that you say you want to make. So this, in some sense, raises confidence about transactions on the Internet. But each of these technologies is Janus-phased in that it's both privacy-protective and privacy-invasive. And the invasive half is that it makes it easier to collect and monitor data about what people are doing or where they've been or what kind of content they've been browsing or what kind of email exchanges they've been having.
Well, that would, on the face of it, sound quite ominous. But if I can just play devil's advocate here for a moment, the government already has the ability, for example, to wiretap your telephone. And it would seem, I guess we can never really know, but it would seem that the government is fairly cautious about whom it wiretaps, and it has to go to a court and present a probable cause for doing so. Should the government's ability to track our movements on the Internet be in and of itself something that we should be alarmed about?
Well, I think that the practices that we've had before are a good clue to the kind of protections we should be insisting on in the future. But the problem with the Internet is that, first, the level of monitoring or surveillance that's possible is much higher. Your mouse droppings are all over the Internet. And the legal protections for privacy in the context of the Internet have not yet been as strongly protected as they are in the context of telephones, which means that the government doesn't have as much of a burden if it wants to be monitoring what's going on the Internet. And technically, in many contexts, the government claims that it doesn't have to make any showing at all because, in a sense, you're displaying the information publicly. And they say what follows from that is that the user deserves no privacy. But that's the kind of hard policy question we need to address in the context of the Internet, whether we have to update our conceptions of what type of data should be protected, regardless of the accidental technical fact that all of it's being spewed out there on the Internet.
So as you look a short distance over the horizon, at what 2004 will bring.
I think what's going to happen in 2004 is, first, that Congress's efforts to protect consumers against spam, for example, will prove to have failed, which means that Internet will continue to be a source of burden for many people and a backdoor into the spreading of viruses and worms that further enable both monitoring and the insecurity of the network. And I think that what that will do is reinvigorate calls for a more centralized, controlled network, ostensibly to protect people against insecurity and against malicious behavior. But the consequence of that more centralized, quote, secure network will be to weaken the opportunities for innovation and creativity, as Steve Levy was describing in the beginning.
So what you're suggesting is that we are slouching toward digital Singapore, a place in cyberspace where we have order and security, but in exchange we surrender a substantial amount of our freedom.
Slouching is more optimistic than I would put it. I think we're racing towards digital Singapore, and largely because people think of this as a black and white technology. Either we have security, which means turn over your privacy, turn over your anonymity, turn over your rights to control data about you to some central authority, whether it's the government or a bunch of companies, or they think you live in anarchy, where you're constantly vulnerable to being abused in all sorts of ways. The reality is that the technology provides many choices in the middle. We could provide technical infrastructures that enable people to protect their privacy more effectively, while simultaneously enabling people who need to trace transactions to trace them, so long as they have a good reason to trace the transaction back to the person who originally started it. So because we have not yet focused on the code or architecture of the network, we will continue down this idiot policymaking path, which is going to lead us increasingly into an internet which will not protect the values that most of us thought were fundamental to our tradition and this technology 10 years ago.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Lawrence Lessig is a professor of law at Stanford University and author of Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace and the Future of Ideas.
Coming up, why court cases consume the media and personalities who impressed the press.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The year's final Nielsen ratings are in, and for the second year in a row, commercial cable networks bested their broadcast counterparts. And once again, Court TV reaped the benefits of America's migration from free TV. Propelled by the high-octane trials and tribulations of Martha Stewart, Scott Peterson, Robert Blake, Phil Spector, Kobe Bryant, and Michael Jackson, the channel posted a 13% boost in its primetime ratings over the previous year. Catherine Cryer is host of the daily Court TV series Catherine Cryer Live, and she joins me now. Catherine, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
What would you say are the common threads among the stories that I just mentioned?
Public interest. because, as you said, some are celebrity. Scott Peterson became a celebrity. Now, there are some, such as Martha Stewart, that really have interesting political nuance, and we're able to talk about that. It's much more than Martha Stewart homemaker, but it's, you know, what is insider trading? What sort of access does someone like Martha have that we don't? We then saw the investigation by Elliot Spitzer and others move beyond just insider trading to the mutual funds and a major examination of the financial industry in this country, I think all for the better.
So a story like Martha Stewart gives you the opportunity to explore a range of important issues all wrapped up in a beautifully salacious celebrity package. And I guess one could say that the Kobe Bryant trial brings up very interesting issues of what constitutes rape and sexual harassment, and perhaps Michael Jackson brings up child welfare issues. It's hard to know, however, how Scott Peterson's, Robert Blake's, or Phil Spector story, for example, could advance the cause of human understanding.
Well, it may not advance the cause of human understanding other than examining the psychology of individuals who may or may not have participated in this case. One of the reasons Scott Peterson's case is so fascinating is people look at this beautiful young woman on the verge of giving birth to the first son of this couple and a handsome young man, Scott Peterson, and think to themselves, if he's guilty, how in the world could he have done this? And so there is, I think, a psychological fascination and maybe even personal examination when we get into looking at some of these stories.
Could you give me a preview of the big legal stories of 2004?
Obviously, Michael Jackson, obviously the trial of Scott Peterson, Robert Blake, Kobe Bryant. But from a personal point of view, I'm fascinated with the whole war on terrorism, the trial of these cases, what's happening in Guantanamo Bay, Saddam Hussein, the Patriot Act, and further legislation that the Justice Department and the Attorney General wants to see passed in this country.
On your show, you've already begun to look at the arrest of Saddam Hussein from a number of legal perspectives. To what extent will your show and Court TV in general cover the trial itself? If it took place, say, in The Hague, there wouldn't be any cameras there. But if it takes place in Iraq, all bets are off.
Well, there may actually be exposure wherever the case occurs, and of course we'll be there in some form or fashion, whatever the powers that be allow. But this is a very important issue. The United States has chosen in certain ways to limit its participation in international criminal courts. Is it going to try and support a court in Iraq? Are we going to push for the death penalty in a country where, at least as of today, there is no legitimate death penalty under their new laws? All sorts of interesting international but also criminal justice issues.
What about the ethics of it all? What about the victims and the accused? Can people truly get a fair trial under the glare of the media spotlight?
It was an interesting question, and I went back and did some research going back literally to the turn of the century and examining high-profile cases that at first received a lot of newspaper coverage, then radio, and finally when television injected itself. And I realized that the number of acquittals versus convictions were pretty consistent. They were pretty evenly balanced no matter what the public and the newspapers and the press were saying at the time. There are a couple of good examples. The McMartin case was that child care case in the late 80s. People were marching up and down the streets with banners saying, "We believe the children." They were acquitted of all counts but one that was deadlocked, and basically that was discharged.
But the McMartin trial was a long time ago. Don't you think that with the increasing interest and the increasing popularity of court TV and of court coverage in general, that it's harder and harder to find a jury pool that hasn't been tainted?
Well, I'll throw out the O.J. case, but I've said it in public many times. Heavens, I thought O.J. was guilty, but that's another story. Robert Durst is a new interesting case. This was in Galveston, Texas, of all places, known for being very hardline. Well, Galveston jury acquitted this man who admitted on the stand to killing another man. They bought the story that it was self-defense. I don't know that I agreed, but this case was covered in the news, covered on court TV, ample information believing this man to be guilty, and yet a jury of 12 acquitted him.
What do you think is going to be the biggest story of next year, Catherine, for your program?
Ooh, if I were to guess early in this year, probably Michael Jackson, if this thing actually goes to trial.
And do you think it'll ultimately really be worth all that screen time?
Oh, now that's the sort of esoteric question that I ask myself every day working in television. I don't know that that's the case at all. Worth the screen time? No, but that's why I write books now and spend a lot of time reading, because I think there are other things we should do with our time than watch television. But it will be a fascinating case and a good look at the criminal justice system.
Okay. Catherine, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke. Take care.
Catherine Cryer is the host of Court TV's daily series, Catherine Cryer Live.
Court TV may be giving the networks a run for their money, but courtroom drama has been riveting audiences for decades, long before cameras were allowed to capture the real action live. WNYC reporter Alicia Zuckerman has the story.
Perry Mason first emerged in the pages of nearly 90 paperbacks by Earl Stanley Gardner in the 1930s, and then on a popular radio series. But in 1957, it was the actor Raymond Burr who personified the Perry Mason that lingers today. Ron Simon is the television curator at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City.
We always go back to that one looming figure of Raymond Burr in television. He created the lawyer. There was something about the incarnation of the lawyer seen on a regular basis that created, in the public opinion, what a lawyer was like.
After Perry Mason, courtroom shows proliferated, ranging in tone from The Defenders to Night Court to L.A. Law. Simon sees that last show as a turning point.
The thing that certainly that Stephen Bochco and David Kelly brought to the legal genre is that the personal life of the L.A. Law character, or Ally McBeal, are as important as the legal cases. In many ways, the craziness that is reflected in the private life erupts in the craziness of the court system, this total confusion of private and public realms.
In fact, the trials on Kelly's The Practice deal largely with the lawyer's personal issues. And in this scene from his show, Ally McBeal, law partners and best friends John Cage and Richard Fish are going to couples therapy to resolve their issues.
That's my problem, is that he always gets to go first. His needs are always prioritized over those of other people. And the horror of that is compounded when you consider that the center of his very being is nothing but sex and money. It's sex and money, sex and money.
In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories.
Now in its 14th season, Law and Order is one of the most successful courtroom dramas in TV history. Unlike The Practice, the show is not character-driven. The case is the star. Executive producer Jeffrey Hayes says that's how it's always been.
The first show we did was the Mayflower Madam show, which we called By Hook or By Crook. And then the second show we did was the Bernie Getz story, which we called Subterranean Homeboy Blues. Ripped from the headline sounds easy. What's hard is to make it dramatically interesting once you get past the crime, once you get into the prosecution.
The show has spawned two spin-offs by creator Dick Wolf. Law and Order Special Victims Unit is now in its fifth season, and Law and Order Criminal Intent went on the air 2 years ago. Hayes explains what he thinks makes the show so successful.
In our courtroom scenes, if you look, we do a lot of cutaways to the victim's relatives. A lot of times we'll stop in the middle of a trial and go to the judge's chambers or do a couple scenes with the jury out. But to me, all that's part of the courtroom drama aspect of it.
Mr. Robinette will ask you to feel sorry for Jenny Mays. That's all right. You can feel sorry for her. But don't forget that there's a dead man here. And don't forget Alex Corbin was abducted by the woman who got him addicted to crack in her womb.
If fictionalized court shows came from Perry Mason, what's the origin of reality court shows? Ron Simon has an answer.
The interesting thing is that reality courtroom drama was also with television from the beginning. If you consider the Army McCarthy hearings, an extended drama in the 50s, then you can see that television was dealing with real-life situations almost from the beginning. There was something intriguing about the courtroom situation.
Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator.
Let's
You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?
Are you not following what I'm saying to you? Is it not piercing through?
If somebody you feel is trying to control your life, you don't put them in a situation where they can do that.
Where courtroom dramas have historically focused on the lawyer, reality shows set the judge at center stage. Today, there are around 10 of these shows that emulate small claims court. Many of them feature some street-smart judge like Judge Judy, who impart wisdom with a sharp tongue. 20 years ago, there was just one, the People's Court. When Judge Wapner went on the air in 1981, he generally handled the People's Court with sobriety and respect. Nowadays, TV courtrooms need to up the ante to pull in viewers. Again, curator Ron Simon.
And the archetypal silent judge who listens and then reacts is really not someone who plays that well on television. You need someone who motivates the action.
Now on its fourth judge, Marilyn Million, the People's Court has taken on characteristics of its high-intensity imitators.
We're done, and now's the part where this is my favorite part. This is the part where the judge rules and no one interrupts her.
Stu Billett, the show's creator and producer, says that all these shows are sort of interchangeable, but it doesn't matter because the public's appetite for them is insatiable.
They're the soup du jour. The only difference, really, is the judge. Like game shows, back in the 60s and 70s, there were 35 game shows on the air.
Now millions of people are watching the justice system play out on the small screen.
It's a problem because these people then go to sit on juries, and they have some tendency to think they know more than they do.
First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams.
People, for example, in criminal cases want to know where the fingerprints are, what the DNA is, when the police don't always get fingerprints and they don't always take DNA sampling.
Abrams still applauds the notion of court shows, both fiction and reality. In fact, he's been an advocate, literally, for cameras in the real-life courtroom.
I had a judge who told me once that because I represented Court TV in a successful effort to get television into the O.J. case, that I was personally responsible for the decline and fall of the legal system.
But few people complained about the Army-McCarthy broadcasts undermining the legal system. Most thought it was good for democracy. It turns out what was good for democracy may even be better for ratings. For On the Media in New York, I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
The magazine The Week and the website I Want Media are polling their readers to determine who will go down in history as the media person of 2003. This year, the winner is, well, we don't know yet. The polls closed on New Year's Eve, and the results haven't been tallied. But it has been a big year for the integrity of newspaper journalism, for deregulation in broadcast, for bloggers, for war reporters, for the freedom of information, and for the First Amendment. It is an impressive list of nominees that represents the good, the bad, and the grotesquely ugly in American media. Patrick Phillips is the founder of iwantmedia.com, and he joins me now. Patrick, welcome to the big show.
Thank you very much.
As you looked over the early polling, did you find less than obvious candidates who, when you saw their names, made you go, there's a thought?
The guys from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, I wouldn't have thought of them, but they did have an impact on popular culture, at least, this year. And some people even nominated TiVo, which obviously is not a person, but then again is expected to have a tremendous impact on the media landscape, not only this past year, but in the coming years. So there are some surprises in there, absolutely.
This is all kind of a parlor game. There is necessarily no single media person of the year, right?
Well, absolutely. We just thought doing this poll would be a fun way to take a look back at the year in media by recognizing some of its most outstanding figures, from some very visionary, powerful CEOs of media companies to a number of media troublemakers, so to speak, some people who stirred up the media landscape, from Jason Blair at the New York Times and Rosie O'Donnell and the situation with her magazine, and people like Al Franken, who appeared to have got under Bill O'Reilly's skin a bit this year.
Who's leading the pack so far?
You know, the poll has already closed, so I'd really hesitate to give it away because we're going to be announcing it later this month. But the people who have received the most votes are Jason Blair at the New York Times and also Bonnie Fuller, who helped revive Us Weekly and then moved on to another high-profile position with American media.
With a newspaper tabloid, right?
Yes.
Star Magazine. And
exactly. So anyway, those two figures are the top of the list.
Okay, and in fact, they would have been at the very top of my list. Jason Blair, I guess, would be my choice, and maybe Bonnie Fuller or Michael Powell, the chairman of the FCC. Now, let me ask you about how you win. Now, you know, we've discussed Jason Blair, so maybe he will turn out to be Media Person of the Year. Maybe he won't. Last year was Martha Stewart. Who on the list are there because of their achievements and not because of some controversy surrounding them?
Well, that's a good question. Because I
and your pause.
Yes, a long pause.
And your pause speaks terrible volumes about the year in media. Patrick, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Patrick Phillips is the founder of IWantMedia.com, which, along with The Week magazine, is sponsoring the Media Person of the Year.
Last week, a catastrophic earthquake in Iran, a fatal earthquake and mudslide in California, a deadly avalanche in Utah, and finally, on Tuesday, reports of a landslide of sorts in the Bronx. The victim was Patrice Moore, trapped for 2 days under a pile of magazines, newspapers, catalogs, and books crammed into a 10-by-10 room. Moore was buried up to his neck in fine publications amassed over a decade, including Sports Illustrated, Vibe, InStyle, Ebony, Sound and Vision, Fitness, Scuba Diving, and the Harvard Business Review. Moore's is one of those there-but-for-the-grace-of-God-go-I sorts of stories. Who among us has not gazed wearily on their own growing pile of unread high-quality journalism heaped by the bed and in the bathroom, balanced precariously on every surface and not side? Life is too short for the New Yorker. Now, obviously, Moore has an illness, and it very nearly killed him. But media immersion, even on a smaller, metaphorical scale, can be risky, and I think you know who you are. Moore's disaster may even suggest a novel New Year's resolution. For the love of God, cut back. Or you could take Moore's suggestion, keeping in mind that he is a very sick man. The problem was, he told a reporter, I never got a storage space.
Coming up, infomercials begin a long, slow slide into TV oblivion, while public relations stays forever young.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. A number of you were rankled by our interview about the New York Times reporters who were refusing to reveal the government sources who fed them information about Wen-Ho Lee, the scientist wrongly accused of passing nuclear secrets to the Chinese. Lucy Delglish, the executive director of Reporters for Freedom of the Press, defended the reporters, much to the dismay of Charles Heitsch of Bourbon, Missouri. He writes that, quote, one has to wonder about a journalist who would protect a source that has passed false information, which was so destructive to an innocent individual. The First Amendment was not designed to protect those who would attack innocent people.
Dr. Francisco Franco notes that, quote, in medicine, there are instances in which the doctor-patient confidentiality has to be broken. For example, if a patient confesses about any suicidal plan or intent, physicians are mandated to report this to emergency services to assure the safety of the patient. The same should be mandated of journalists when the welfare of someone is at stake. I think that helping Mr. Lee clear up his name is a moral imperative that supersedes any excuse of ethics that potentially hides slanderers.
And if your letters are any indication, our listeners are just as ambivalent about video games as they are about journalistic ethics. Travis McCrory Gardner of Dallas, Texas tells us, I was actually playing a video game when I heard your story on games. It is indeed true that all most people know about video games is Space Invaders is sort of fun and Grand Theft Auto is too violent. Most people can't imagine a game like Final Fantasy X, which has 6 hours of voice acting to tell a story about sacrificing yourself for others. People should just keep in mind that, like any other medium, in games there are differences between art and, well, crap.
We want to know what you think about art, or crap, as long as it's media. Write to us at onthemedia.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. In our ongoing coverage of the transformation of TV advertising, today we bring you the infomercial. You know what they are, but let us remind you anyway.
Even you. Yeah, you. So sit, stay, and we'll be right back.
Since we're bombarded every day by one dietary claim after another, you need more fiber. It's okay to drink red wine. Are you getting enough
vitamin E? Are you spending your life wishing for firmer breasts? And you do it naturally.
Infomercials were huge not too long ago, when making a million overnight didn't seem like that big of a deal, and everyone, yes, everyone, knew the three words, Psychic Friends Network. But that was then. Now, viewers have hundreds of channels to choose from, and of course, there's TiVo, enabling viewers to skip the ads altogether. So, how is the infomercial industry keeping up? When was the last time you saw an ad for the Psychic Friends Network? Stephen Dworman's latest book is $12 Billion of Inside Marketing Secrets Discovered Through Direct Response Television Sales. He joins me now from NPR Studios in Los Angeles. Steve, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks so much. Hi, Bob.
Tell me about how it was when things were great.
Well, when things were great, Mike Warren, the founder of Psychic Friends Network, used to legitimately say that he'd wake up in the morning and find himself $1 million richer from the psychic calls that came in overnight.
Apart from the Psychic Friends Network, what were the big, big blockbuster programs, as they called them, in the industry?
One of the big early successes in the late 80s was Blue Blocker Sunglasses. Blue Blocker was selling an average of about $50 million worth of sunglasses per year for a period of about 3 to 4 years. And then, of course, the industry really kind of took a new turn in 1989, where two breakthrough shows came on the air, one of them for Victoria Jackson Cosmetics that featured Ally McGraw and Lisa Hartman. And nobody had seen celebrities like this on an infomercial before. Then you also had Tony Robbins with Personal Power, which was a real breakthrough infomercial as far as documentary style with incredible production values.
In the early days, infomercials had just a bizarre attraction to them. It was kind of a car wreck experience where you don't want to look, but you really do.
There certainly was an element of that because, except for these real quality shows that were being produced, I mean, people were doing these shows really cheaply. We actually saw an experiment that was done by a guy named Tony Hoffman. He showed a kitchen appliance show that he produced extremely cheaply, and the show just started doing extremely well, and he felt so guilty about how bad the show looked. He went back and parlayed some of the profits and redid the show with the same host, same demonstrator, same product, but upgraded the set, upgraded the graphics, even upgraded how the audience looked. And they tested that, and the entire thing just bombed, and they went back to the terrible version.
I actually was in Las Vegas for one of the infomercial conventions, and it had just the most amazing Gold Rush feel to it. Everybody had come there to make their fortunes, and I guess a few of them did, but the predictions that the infomercial was going to dominate the universe didn't seem quite to pan out. What's the landscape like nowadays?
It's much more difficult to make a profit, primarily for two reasons. The cost of media has gone up as much as five times in the last 5 or 6 years, and there are fewer eyeballs watching each station because there are quite a few more stations and cable networks. When these early infomercials started running, Bob, people had nine television stations on their dial, and people would hang around the water cooler and talk about, did you see Ally McGraw on television last night?
So who is, in this changed environment, out there still succeeding in this genre? Somebody's making money.
Actually, when everything is said and done, the company that ended up at the top of the heap is a very smart company called Guthy Ranker Corporation. And they were one of the pioneers, starting with Tony Robbins and Victoria Principal. And then their big one, which is running consistently, is for an acne medication called Proactiv. Proactiv alone does close to about $600 million a year in sales, and the company overall this year will be doing over $1 billion in sales. They were very, very smart in really spending a lot of time developing their back end and building up continuity products, which are products that they're not really making a profit off of their television sale because the media is so expensive, but the product is so good that people continuously reorder it every month or every 2 months, and that's where their primary sales come from.
One of the fundamentals of direct marketing, you don't make money with your first sale, but it's the upsell later that keeps the cash flowing in, eh?
And that's one of the other things, the third thing probably that has changed the business outside of what we've talked about is the fact that because you don't make a profit on the first sale where you used to in the late 80s and early 90s, you have to, as a company, have extremely deep pockets to finance all of that until your campaign becomes profitable.
Steve, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bob.
Stephen Dworman's book is $12 Billion of Inside Marketing Secrets Discovered Through Direct Response Television Sales. You can get more information at www.drtvsecrets.com.
Selling a product that people don't need is child's play compared to selling a product that people are scared of, like, for example, beef. Currently, the St. Petersburg Times reports, the mad cow incident in Washington State has prompted Outback Steakhouse to wage very different PR campaigns in different parts of the world. Here, the company is saying that all their beef, which is American-grown, is safe, nothing to worry about. In Korea, it's plastering the walls with notices that all its beef comes from Australia, which is true. History has shown that public relations, skillfully applied, can convince people of almost anything, and that history can be said to have begun with one man. What follows is the story of that self-proclaimed father of public relations. In 1917, Enrico Caruso was coming to America. It was a multi-city tour, and his sponsors were molto apprehensive. The great tenor was demanding and capricious and not likely to win the hearts of the heartland, so Caruso's backers turned to America's consummate salesman, 25-year-old Edward L. Bernays. Bernays, fresh from 3 years promoting the Ballet Russe, paved Caruso's way with press releases extolling the man with the orchid-lined voice. He soothed and petted the transcendent tenor through Toledo, Pittsburgh, and Cincinnati, while regaling editors with tales that made Caruso an American hero before he sang a note. Bernays understood that shaping America's taste was not so hard once you had the key, and he knew the master locksmith. Bernays' mother was Sigmund Freud's sister. His father was brother to Freud's wife. Thus, young Edward was Freud's double nephew. And despite the doctor's occasional disdain for his relentlessly entrepreneurial relative, they'd take long walks together in Carlsbad.
He helped Bernays understand that you needed history, you needed sociology, and most importantly, you needed an understanding of psychology to know why people bought or voted or generally behaved the way they did so that you could help reshape that behavior.
Larry Tye is author of The Father of Spin, which chronicles the development of Bernays' signature approach, which he called the engineering of consent. That's what America's first PR men did for the Woodrow Wilson administration when they embarked on a determined effort to sell an isolationist America on the war to end all wars, the costliest propaganda campaign up until then. Bernays was a junior member of that campaign, but 7 years later he was ready for another Washington hard sell, a president whose personality was so sour, said Alice Longworth Roosevelt, he looked as if he'd been weaned on a pickle.
I believe in the American Constitution. I favor the American system of individual enterprise, and I am opposed to any general extension of government ownership and control.
Calvin Coolidge. Bernays used a cheap trick, glamour by association, to turn a cold fish into a hot dog by loading a crowd of stars and starlets onto a midnight train to Washington and then onto the White House, where they whooped it up with Cal and the wife. The headlines blazed with such scoops as, "Actors eat cake with the Coolidges."
I believe not only in advocating economy in public expenditure, but in its practical application and actual accomplishment.
As the New York Times said in a headline the next day, "President almost laughs." Did that transform his image? No. Was it important, one little thing that helped him win re-election? Absolutely. Was it important in setting a stage for today's spinmeisters? Absolutely, lutely.
Bernays' most famous, or infamous, campaign to engineer consent involved the overthrow of a long-standing taboo, that against women smoking. In an interview shortly before his death in 1995, Bernays recalled that campaign.
One day, Mr. George Hill, president of the American Tobacco Company, called me in and said, "We're losing half of our market." I said, "Have I your permission to see a psychoanalyst?"
If he couldn't go directly to his uncle Sigmund Freud, he went to Freud's disciple, Dr. A.A. Brill.
I went to Dr. Brill and asked him what cigarettes meant to women, and he answered very quickly, "Cigarettes are torches of freedom to women. They want to smoke to dramatize man's taboo." And then he added, as an afterthought, "and they titillate the erogenous zones of the lips." It occurred to me that any young debutante who was aware of the times would be delighted to walk in the Easter parade from 34th Street to 57th, lighting torches of freedom to protest man's inhumanity to women by a taboo against smoking.
This incredible march was so delectable that every newspaper in America had a picture on their front page the next day of these women, very elegantly dressed, with a cigarette dangling from their hand or from their mouth.
Within 3 days, women were smoking in Union Square in San Francisco, Union Square in Denver, and on the Boston Common in solidarity with their sisters in New York.
Then in 1920, women won their rights.
You've come a long way, baby.
Introducing New Virginia Slims, the slim cigarette for women only, tailored for the feminine hand. Slimmer than the fat cigarettes men smoke, with flavor women like.
Bernays was always quick to point out that all this happened 3 decades before the Surgeon General's report on smoking. No one really understood the dangers, except, as Larry Tye points out, Eddie Bernays did.
One of his jobs for American Tobacco was to take any reports indicating the risks of smoking. If he could, he was to cover them up, and if he couldn't, he was to make fun of them. At home, he told his 2 young daughters that if they found their mother's cigarettes in the house, they should, as he said, break them in half like brittle bones and flush them down the toilet.
In his book Propaganda, Bernays observed that our minds are molded largely by men we have never heard of. This invisible government, he said, is a logical requirement of democracy, which needs a consensus for things to run smoothly. And Bernays enthusiastically manipulated what he called this unseen mechanism of society. To sell books to a lukewarm public, he found celebrities to attest to the value of the printed word and then convinced architects to build bookshelves into their housing designs. To sell bacon to people inclined toward orange juice in a roll, he tapped doctors to pitch the health benefits of a heavy breakfast. And then in 1954, to safeguard the business interests of the United Fruit Company, he convinced the United States to make a revolution in Guatemala. Larry Tye.
Bernays took this government that was actually quite tepid in its socialism and helped shape them as a danger in the public eye.
Guatemala's new government was engaged in a reform program, turning over tracts of uncultivated acreage to 100,000 poor families. Some of that land belonged to the United Fruit Company. Bernays led the media on carefully orchestrated tours of Guatemala, emphasizing the danger it posed to the U.S. until American covert action helped to topple the Guatemalan government. The new rulers used terror to consolidate power through dislocation, torture, and murder. John Stauber is the editor of the newsletter PR Watch.
He was dressing up an overthrow of an elected government and the installation of a brutal military regime. So we would think our government policies were doing the good thing, the pro-democracy thing, in a country like Guatemala.
Since then, PR professionals often have enlisted in foreign wars. Hillen Knowlton, for example, was hired by the Kuwaiti government during the Persian Gulf War, arranging for hair-raising tales of Iraqis dumping babies out of incubators to be told on the floor of the Capitol, though the charge was never proved. Still, when the public does catch sight of the man behind the curtain, it reacts, like Dorothy did, with rage and contempt. Successful public relations professionals know that when skepticism reigns, honesty and openness are powerful persuaders. That's how Johnson & Johnson reacted when packages of tainted Tylenol were found in 1982. It opened its doors to reporters who closely followed the investigation.
The net result of their openness was that Tylenol came back like gangbusters, as opposed to what everybody had feared at the beginning, which is that Tylenol as a brand would be dead.
Marilyn Lorry spent most of her career in the top ranks of corporate PR at AT&T.
The public relations people associated with the Tylenol incident are heroes in the profession.
But almost by definition, public relations is an invisible enterprise. And Bernays' pioneering strategies, using celebrities and scientists, linking products with causes and status, still work their magic, still engineer our consent.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.